Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Haikung Lee, who is a senior lecturer in culture and creative industries at King's College London, about her new book, Cultural Policy in South Korea, Making a New Patron State. So welcome to the podcast.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
This is a great book. It's really, really interesting, partially because South Korea is really, really interesting, but also because it makes several quite important theoretical contributions to our understanding of cultural policy and its relationship to governments and states. And I guess the sort of like the place to start with the book is like, why are we interested in writing this book? I mean, partially South Korea is like a really popular topic for cultural and media studies, but also be interesting to hear like why you're interested in, I guess, making a theoretical contribution as
You know, basically, I can say that I'm from South Korea. I've always very interested in, you know, better understanding of this, the relationship, very complicated relationship, historically complicated relationship between culture and the state. So I was thinking, I've written some articles and then decided to write a book on this topic so that I can provide more in-depth analysis, historical and political analysis of the development of cultural policy in South Korea. So basically, I had personal interest on this topic. And another reason for why we need to look at South Korean cultural policy, why it matters, is that in South Korea, we tend to see one of the most complicated and sophisticated cultural policies in the world. You know, you can find many different programs and schemes for supporting culture and the arts. So why not having a look? And I think that the book will attract attention of, you know, cultural policy researchers who work on other countries, context. And as you mentioned that South Korea is becoming popular in the field of cultural policy studies because of the success of K-pop and K-drama. And many people are really interested in what happens with the policy, you know, how the policy has contributed to the success and the recent and current success of the Korea's cultural industries. And I believe that the state and government agencies has played certain important roles in promoting these industries. So one of the chapters is dealing with the issue. And initially, I was thinking about the book title, Cultural Policy in South Korea, From Cultural Control to the Korean Wave. And then I changed the title, subtitle to Making a New Patron State, because I wanted to, highlight the centrality of the state in defining the cultural life of Korea, people in Korea, and also, you know, promoting, you know, arts and cultural industries. One of the aims of this book is to, expanding the base, our understanding of the state, and then contributing the theorization and conceptualization of the state in relation to culture.
Yeah, I mean, the question of the state is, you can argue it's almost a kind of foundational question for cultural policy and cultural policy studies and sort of development of particularly whether it's a kind of, you know, the state and its relationship to the public sphere, or whether it's the state and its, you know, as you talk about in the book, you know, its mechanisms of cultural control and you know, the governmentality of culture. But obviously, you know, you mentioned that kind of new theorization, and that's in the subtitle, isn't it? This idea of a new patron state. And I think before we sort of get into, I suppose, the development of the new patron states, which again is fascinating in the Korean context because of the historical narrative you've got, it's probably worth us kind of saying, what is it? What are we talking about here with this idea, this object, the new patron state?
Yeah. I suppose that the notion of patron state is familiar for cultural policy researchers. You know, it was born in the context of Western Europe and North America, and it broadly refers to state acting as a benevolent patron for arts and culture, and state having established a system for cultural subsidy. And here, at the center of this notion, I think there is this combination of cultural, you know, freedom. You know, these existing patron states, they are found in the Western Europe and North American countries. So we have this combination of cultural control, cultural freedom, and state intervention in the form of subsidy. You know, this is the basic understanding of the patron state. And here, state intervenes in culture for the purpose of heritage protection, artistic excellence, and the public accessibility, etc. You know, the patron states found in the North America and the European, you know, countries, they tend to be different in terms of the rules assigned to the state and the degree of decentralization, centralization of policymaking, and the relationship between key actors in police network. In the case of Korea, Korea went through this very successful democratization process. You know, thanks to that, I think that Korea now is on par with the Western patron states. Artists and cultural organizations, they enjoy cultural freedom, and the state are willing to, you know, act as a, you know, patron for the cultural sector. And the country now has a very, you know, robust and well-established system for you know, cultural investment and cultural subsidy.
And, which has been incredibly successful terms of export.
And, you know, Korea's patron states goes beyond that. And because the Korean government kind of, you know, invented a new responsibility of the patron state, which is, you know, applying the industrial logic to the cultural, you know, policy and systematically support cultural industry so that the industry can work for the, you know, the development of the national economy. So there is very strong economic orientation in the case of Korean cultural policy. So in that sense, I would say that Korea can be seen as a kind of new type of patron state where we can see a very interesting combination of the democratic approach, understanding of culture, and a very statist, you know, management of cultural policy, and as well as, you know, this, you know, cultural freedom and cultural autonomy.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, I suppose, opportunities for the development of cultural policy in Korea comes with Korea's modernization agenda and the perceived or actual need for modernization, which obviously there isn't the same context in some of the patron states of the US, France, UK, or wherever. And that, you know, sort of heavily interventionist in some ways, relationship between state and cultural production is one of the things that underpins this new model almost. In order to kind of understand that, I think you do need to know a bit, and the book's really good on this actually, of the kind of history of that modernization project. So, you know, the kind of sense of moving from US rule and the war, both actually, you know, in terms of the Korean War, but also after the end of the Second World War, to being a kind of like fully almost like hyper-technological advanced industrial nation. And I wonder if you could like sketch out maybe the kind of, I suppose, the key cultural elements of that modernization story.
Yes, I think that Korean cultural policy or Korea's understanding of culture reflects this very turbulent social, historical, and political trajectory the Korean society went on over time. So there was Japanese colonization, where sort of modern cultural policy firstly was introduced to Korean, society. So like film policy, theater policy, museum policy, heritage policy, they were introduced during this period as part of colonial governance. You can see that there is a strong element of education, social education, but at the same time, this education came with, you know, physical and symbolic violence towards Korea's indigenous and popular and folk culture. So that happened during the colonial period. And then it was followed by liberation. But after the liberation, Korea was occupied by the U.S. military for 3 years. And, you know, during this period, the U.S. Military occupiers wasn't really interested into, you know, supporting arts and culture in Korea. They were not very, I think, they weren't impressed by contemporary Korean arts and artists. What they did was kind of basically listing heritage sites and artifacts and provide some basic, you know, protection for cultural heritage. And that was one part. And the other part was, you know, a lot of, you know, the concerns with socialist artists, their activities, and, you know, and then kind of, you know, suppression of what they were doing. And then there was to be understood within this bigger picture of Cold War that was going on at the time. And then after the U.S. military occupation, Korea had an independent, you know, became really independent and then had its own government, etc. However, the government wasn't democratic and there was an authoritarian rule, and then the government was lacking resource and was dealing with more urgent economic issues and political economic issues. So cultural policy wasn't on the agenda of the government. So there was lack of resource for the cultural sector, and the independent Korea during this period until early 60s couldn't afford make an active cultural policy, if you like. And then the situation changed a lot with the arrival of the president, a new president, Park Chung-hee, who was a dictator. So we had a dictatorship in Korea throughout the 1960s and until 1979. This period is really interesting because there was very heavy cultural censorship and cultural control, you know, and very top-down, you know, the police making regarding, you know, mobilizing Korean population for this, you know, grand project of modernization of the country. And modernization initially was an economic project. It's making the country, you know, get out of the poverty. Korea, you know, until early 60s, Korea was one of the most, you know, poorest countries in the world. So it's kind of removing the poverty and then, you know, make it industrialize and then, you know, catching up with in the economically advanced countries. So that was a key agenda for the modernization project. But at the same time, it was a political project as well. So it's achieving, you know, developing so-called Koreanized or localized democracy that could better manage this process of economic modernization. So Koreanized democracy was a controlled democracy, you know, led by top-down, top-down way by the government and under the elite leadership. And Korean people were supposed to contribute to this process, and they were also expected to become obedient citizens and productive workers, again, contributing to the modernization project. And then cultural policy was contributing to this process a lot. And the government was promoting national culture and seeing it as a container of national spirit, hopes, and aspirations. So basically, national culture refers to a set of traditions and heritage and, you know, cultural activities. But not all heritage and all traditional arts were seen as national culture, and it was kind of filtered by this lens of patriotism and collective sense of national unity and yes. So basically, the government was quite selective when it talks about national culture and then expected the whole population to kind of, you know, to learn about it and practice it and make contribution to the advancement of national culture in this sense.
I mean, and to an extent, we get what you'd expect in the transition to democracy and democratization reflected in the cultural sector. So, you know, if we have the authoritarian period is a story of, culture being used to create an imagined community that can modernize the economy, but also, as you say, you know, has a Korean democracy in the sense of a quite elite-led controlled project. We get a period of, I was quite interested in this, the kind of sense of a period of almost kind of like culture wars going on over, the kind of struggles for what culture should be, what its role should be. I guess, you know, sometimes you might think of this in terms of being artistic freedom, about what should be kind of almost, you know, sort of the state's ability to frame but not to control culture. And I found that fascinating because that period and that moment of transition and development sets up the grounds for what becomes this incredibly successful economic project.
Yeah, basically, I think that, as I mentioned, this period under the dictatorial rule of Park Chung-hee is really important because, you know, this is period of cultural control, but at the same time, this is a period where the government develop the capacity to make, you know, cultural policy in an efficient way, in providing resources and also developing a structure for cultural promotion. So there was very heavy political agenda, ideological agenda, and there was a big, you know, heavy cultural control. But at the same time, this is a period where kind of the period that can be seen as a beginning of the contemporary cultural policy. So the cultural bureaucracy, its shape, its capacity, the way how it operates has been inherited by later democratic governments. So in that sense, there is both continuation and discontinuation of cultural policy under the authoritarian government. And then it was followed by very successful democratization, and where cultural activism was a big part. There were, when it comes to the later part of the 1980s, there were many arts groups and cultural organizations who fought, for cultural freedom, and also who competed for the ownership of national culture, because they wanted to broaden the meaning of culture. They wanted to go beyond this official understanding of national culture. But they, at the same time, they were sticking to this idea of national culture. So their strategy was to reinterpret the meaning of national culture by referring to grassroots cultural expressions and folk tradition of Korea, and also, pointing out the importance of the social roles and political roles of artists and, cultural organizations. So there was a lot of, collaboration, kind of the connection between, democratic movement and cultural activism during this period. And that's made a big impact on cultural policy as well. So what I think that is quite interesting is the constructive response from the Korean government during this period, particularly in the early 90s. So, cultural ministry, they discarded cultural propaganda. So this role of, disseminating public information was moved from the cultural ministry to another department within the government. So cultural ministry from that time was supposed to promote culture and rather than control in the cultural sector and artists. And so there was a big moment for Korean cultural policy. And very recently, we had some scandals around cultural funding, cultural investment. And I think this scandal, the ministry and the cultural agencies produced a list of, kind of blacklist of artists so that they could be excluded from art funding and cultural investment, which cannot be accepted. And people were shocked and very angry about this. And then, artists, they protested a lot and they demanded, government apology, and also they demanded a big change in cultural policy. And, that happened during the previous administration. And I think that, and then the president, previous and the president was criticized a lot, and she was ousted eventually. So that means that that sort of happening wouldn't occur in the future easily. It isn't acceptable in Korea. But I think that it's easy for us to blame the former president and those who co-opted with the Blue House and the president. But at the same time, I think that we need to kind of sit down and think about why this happened, and maybe we can understand it from the context of the rising divisive politics in Korea. There is increasing kind of schism between the left and the right. And then before this blacklist scandal happened, there were kind of media sort of, debate about, where the cultural, public cultural resources are heading to, who are getting more, the left and the right. There were this sort of debate, and I think this reflects and also part of the rising divisive politics in South Korea.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, what's so fascinating about it is the both lineage of authoritarian control, which, you know, once you've got those policy levers, even in a democratic context, it's always kind of tempting to pull them, you know, to kind of carry on using them. But at the same time, it's a story that I guess is not the dominant narrative of Korean cultural policy now, partially because we might think of Korean cultural policy in the context of being, you know, sort of almost entrepreneurial, creative industries style cultural policy, which, you know, talk about, but you're sort of cautious over, and you want to, you know, kind of point attention to the historical lineages. And then at the same time, you know, as we've gestured towards already, and might have been the title of, or the subtitle of the book, the Korean Wave, which is the kind of like the thing that people, you know, almost think is the only kind of story of cultural policy. So I suppose it'd be good to hear a bit about that kind of sense of the creative industry's moment, and you know, that kind of like that entrepreneurial moment, but shaped by what had come before. And then, yeah, the story of the Korean Wave is maybe like, I suppose the kind of like something that under the surface has a lot of debates associated with it, and wasn't, you know, a kind of simple story of just like, oh, you know, nation branding and industrialized cultural production. Actually, you know, there's a lot more going on.
Yeah. And yes, and I think that many people are interested in Korean cultural business because of this, you know, success of the country's cultural businesses and industries. And I believe that it's difficult to scientifically prove how much the state-driven cultural policy has made contributions to the success of the Korean Wave. It's difficult to, you know, to find out scientifically. However, you know, you can see easily there are connections. There is a lot of, you know, there have been a lot of support from the government for the cultural industries since the 1990s. So it has been almost, you know, 20 years. And also during this period, the cultural industries in Korea have grown a lot, very rapidly, have been globalized a lot. And you can point out this, the government concern with cultural export, and, you know, as early as the 1998, you know. So from the very beginning of Korea's cultural industries policy, there was very strong concern about this export potential of the country's cultural commodities. And so so I was kind of thinking, you know, that, that we can compare what has happened in Korea under this idea of cultural industries policy and what happened in the UK. It's really interesting to compare. In the UK, although there has been a lot of discussion around creative industries and relevant policy, and actually the government hasn't really deeply involved in providing, you know, investment and funding for the industries. And it prefers investing in education and training programs, and also investing in regional cultural clusters. So in a way that the UK approach is quite indirect, and it prefers a horizontal approach, kind of, rather than dealing with individual industries.
And there's such an aesthetic hierarchy as well. Like mm-hmm. one thing that's really strongly striking is the sense that, you know, the state in the UK would, it's been involved with film, but mm-hmm. it wouldn't be, you know, we must set up our own film industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has strong involvement in particular, like, you know, classical music, for mm-hmm. example, but at no point would it be like, we need a state-owned record label mm-hmm. and we should be industrial players in that sense.
Yeah. So in a way, that UK approach is kind of found in its creative industry policies quite similar, to what we see in its arts policies, kind of reservation about the strong state and direct intervention. But, you know, something which is contrasting that it has happened in Korea. So from the very beginning, Korean government was kind of passionate about, very into, the providing industry-specific support while dealing with generic issues as well, such as skills issues and copyright and, you know, infrastructure provision, etc. So in Korea, almost all, each industry belonging to cultural industries or creative industries has, be given some sort of support from the government. So in a way, I think it's really intriguing because the Korean government's policy for and on cultural industries is in between cultural policy and industrial policy. And I think it's closer to industrial policy in terms of its rationale and policy options. The policy means, it is really, you know, commercially driven and economic century and export driven. But at the same time, this doesn't mean that the small government or reduction of government investment. Again, we have very strong market agenda and very strong state, presence. I think this makes Korea's approach very intriguing and puzzling for people. And a Korean wave, I think this is really interesting area because, you know, here people, again, going back to this question, what comes first? Some people, say that maybe there are state support, therefore the Korean wave. And some people say that Korean wave comes first and then state support follows. And I think that Korean wave started as a consumption phenomena abroad without government intervention or Korean government support. But as of the middle of 2000s, the Korean government saw what was happening abroad. And it thought that, there is a lot of export potential there. And then also this cultural export and the Korean wave could be good for nation branding and good for selling Korean-made, commodities beyond cultural products. So government began systematically supporting, the Korean wave in various ways, and government, collect data on overseas cultural, overseas consumption of Korea's cultural commodities, the activities of overseas cultural, Korean wave fandom communities, etc.
But it always brings us back to where we started, in the sense of there's also the element of a particular kind of globalized democratic society, nationalism, but achieved, through completely different means to the sorts of kind of formal cultural education programs of the authoritarian era. And it just struck me as fascinating as, you have a whole different kind of set of techniques that, you know, have totally different status for artistic and cultural products, different, you know, set of discourses around artistic and cultural freedom, but you still have that, almost in that kind of Foucauldian sense, the productivity of a particular kind of national consciousness.
Yes, yeah. How do I say? It's using culture for governing society, governing, you know, the people. You know, that has existed, you know, over time. So it was very overt and very direct during the authoritarian period. And we don't have that sort of cultural control, but we have you know, kind of implicit, you know, sort of cultural control. I think the term cultural control is too strong, but implicit way of shaping people's thinking and way of life using culture, in this case, you know, using Korean wave elements. And in this book, I've, you know, suggest some very exciting examples showing that sort of approach. You know, one example is web dramas, you know, commissioned and created by public authorities, public agencies dealing with employment, SME, finance, etc., using Korean wave elements such as Korean wave stars, well-known stars and pop idols, and dealing with stories where young people, young generation Koreans, learn lessons, you know, about how to survive in the tough, you know, socio-economic environment, you know, by being more resilient, being hardworking and getting, you know, support from government agencies, etc., or being by being, you know, globally ambitious. So in a way that, you know, still I think that we have this kind of gentle push from the government about how to live and how to sort of how to behave, how to be a good citizen in this, you know, new environment of, you know, neoliberal and neoliberal post-industrial economy. And also, I think that in that sense, it's really interesting to look at the roles played by the Korean wave discourse. And in the book I mentioned about this, the young people, groups of young people who, you know, try to learn, you know, kind of skills, entrepreneurial skills and event management skills and new skills, and have global and international experiences by, you know, going abroad and doing something with the local people within the framework of the Korean wave. And they are sort of self-appointed cultural ambassadors of the country, and they are sort of, they are not patriotic, but, you know, but at the same time, I think that what they are doing is very nationalistic, you know, promoting Korean food and Korean culture voluntarily, and combining, you know, this endeavor with, you know, an entrepreneurship and business, etc. So that's interesting to look at, I suppose.
I mean, there's like so much more we could talk about in the book. The book is really kind of rich in detail with examples, as well as the historical and theoretical analysis. I guess we might conclude, though, in thinking about what do you do next after a book like this? You know, because, I mean, it's so kind of comprehensive. Are you thinking about writing more about Korean cultural policy? Are you thinking about doing more, you know, kind of theoretical work around the new patron state? Or are you going to do something completely different?
Yeah, I have a few different projects that are related with each other and also to this book, Korean Cultural Policy, on Korean Cultural Policy. So I want to explore the roles of, you know, the nature of cultural policy in the divisive society such as Korea today, you know, cultural policy in relation to the divisive politics. That's cultural policy. In other words, cultural policy after the democratization, what it looks like. That's one project.
Which would be useful for Britain, America, France.
I think so. And the next the one is to look at this dynamics between market forces and state forces in Korea's cultural industries project. So I'm thinking of writing a book on the relationship between the cultural industries and the state, primarily in Korea, but I hope that I can bring in some comparative perspective as well. Recently, I've compared creative industries policies in the UK and Korea, and then I want to also look at the experience of France, so there can be some interesting comparison. These are the main projects which I'm thinking at the moment.